Chapter 15. A gun, no matter if it looks small and insignificant or massive and downright mean, is always a perfect attention-getter. To say that Giordino was the center of attraction would be a classic understatement. He played the role to the hilt, the automatic held at full arm's length, a grim smile on his face. If Academy Awards were given for sheer bravado, he'd have won at least three. For a long moment, no one spoke. Then finally, Zeno rammed a fist into one hand. A wan smile etched his swarthy face. "It was I who said you two men were cunning and dangerous, and yet I am foolish enough to keep offering you new opportunities to prove it." "We don't relish these embarrassing little scenes any more than you do," Pitt said equably. "Now, if you gentlemen will excuse us, we'll close up shop and go home." "No sense getting shot in the back." Giordino waved the baby automatic negligently at the three narcotics officers. "We'd better borrow their guns before we exit stage right." "That won't be necessary," Pitt said. "No one is going to pull any triggers." He looked into Zakynthos' eyes, then into Zeno's, and found them thoughtful and speculative. "It's really a standoff. You're tempted, but you won't shoot us from behind because you're all honorable men. Besides, it wouldn't be practical. The investigation of our deaths would only prove to be a messy affair. Von Till would love that. On the other hand, you know damn well we won't shoot back because we don't have nearly enough at stake to kill any one of you. Patience. I ask nothing but patience on your parts for the next 10 hours. I promise you, Zack, we will meet again before sunset, and on much friendlier terms." Pitt's voice seemed strangely prophetic, and the speculative look in Zakynthos' eyes changed to blank puzzlement. Pitt was briefly tempted to prolong the game of cat and mouse. Then he thought better of it. Zakynthos and Zeno appeared resigned to defeat, but not Darius. The huge brute moved 2 steps forward. His face was flushed with anger, and his fists opened and closed like the shells of 2 giant South Pacific clams. It was clearly the time to beat a quick and orderly retreat. Pitt moved slowly around the front of the truck, using the hood and fenders as a barrier between him and Darius. He climbed behind the steering wheel, wincing slightly as the sun-splashed seat burned his naked thighs and back, and started the engine. Giordino followed him into the cab, never taking his eyes off the men beside the Mercedes, the gun very level in his hand. Then, calmly, without any sign of desperate speed, Pitt smoothly shifted gears and aimed the truck toward Brady Field and the first attempt's whaleboat dock. He glanced in the rearview mirror, then to the road and back to the mirror again several times until the three figures in the road disappeared when the truck rounded a curve through an ancient grove of olive trees. "Nothing like a gun to even the odds," Giordino sighed, leaning back comfortably against the seat. "Let's see that popgun." Giordino passed it, butt first. "You'll have to admit it came in damn handy." Pitt studied the Lilliputian gun, looking up from time to time to dodge potholes in the road. He recognized it as a vest pocket Mauser, .25 caliber, the type European women favored for protection. It could easily be concealed in a purse or garter. It was only good for close-in work. Past 10 feet, the accuracy, even in the hands of an expert, was hopeless. "We must consider ourselves extremely lucky." "Lucky hell," Giordino grunted flatly. "That little baby evened the odds. Why do you think the old-time gangsters called a gun an equalizer?" "Would you have pulled the trigger if Zack and his boys had decided not to cooperate?" Pitt asked. "Without hesitation," Giordino replied confidently. "I'd have only winged them in the arms or legs. No sense in killing someone who keeps you supplied with Metaxa brandy." "I can see you have a lot to learn about German automatics." Giordino's eyes narrowed. "What do you mean by that?" Pitt slowed to pass a small boy who was leading a heavily laden donkey. 2 things. First, a .25 caliber gun is hardly a man-stopper. You could have emptied the clip into Darius, but without a killing shot to the heart or head, you'd never have even slowed him down. And second, the expression on your face when you squeezed off the first shot would have been a sight to behold. Pitt casually tossed the gun onto Giordino's lap. "The safety catch is still on." Pitt glanced briefly across the truck cab at Giordino. Giordino's eyes fell blankly to the gun in his lap. He made no attempt to pick it up. His face was expressionless, but Pitt knew him well enough to recognize an acute case of bafflement. Giordino shrugged and gave Pitt a thin smile. "Kind of looks like Giordino the Kid just won the Idiot Award of the Year. I just plumb forgot about the safety." "You've never owned a Mauser. Where did you get it?" "It belonged to your little playmate of the month. I discovered it when I was lugging her through the tunnel. She had it taped to her leg." "You little bastard," Pitt said evenly. "You mean you had it all the time we were having our brains beat out by Darius?" "Sure," Giordino nodded. "I concealed it inside one of my socks. I never had a chance to use it. You jumped Frankenstein before I was ready. After that, the brawl happened too fast. The next thing I knew, I was flat on my back getting my head crushed. Then it was too late. I couldn't reach the pea-shooter." Pitt became silent. Already his mind was on another subject. It was still early in the morning, and the trees edging the road threw their long, misproportioned shadows toward the west. He drove mechanically, 100 questions, 100 doubts circulating through his mind. He didn't know where to start, and there was the plan that had taken form back there overlooking those surf-pounded cliffs. The plan, at best, was a gamble, a long shot backed by nothing but an overpowering urge to carry it out. And then he was automatically depressing the brake pedal, slowing the truck down and stopping at the Brady Field main gate. 40 minutes later, they were climbing the boarding ladder of the first attempt. The deck was deserted, but a chorus of hearty male laughter accompanied by the high-pitched giggle of a woman echoed from the mess room. Pitt and Giordino entered and found Terry surrounded by the entire crew and scientific staff of the ship. She was dressed, or undressed, in a knotted makeshift bikini that looked as if it would come unfurled at the first sign of a passing offshore breeze. She perched prettily on the mess table, the center of attraction, a queen holding court, and it was obvious that she enjoyed every male eyeball. Pitt bemusedly studied the men's faces for a moment. It was an elementary task to separate the scientists from the professional crewmen. The latter stood quietly and gazed lecherously at the generous display of feminine skin, their minds throwing pornographic scenes on the inside walls of their skulls like movie projectors. Most of the vocal activity came from the scientists. The marine biologists, the meteorologists, the geologists, each vying with frantic zeal for Terry's attention and behaving like schoolboys whose dormitory had just been invaded by a box office sex queen. Commander Gunn saw Pitt and came over to him. "I'm glad you're back. Our radio man is about to go psycho. Since dawn this morning, he's been receiving signals faster than he can write. Most of them are marked for your attention." Pitt nodded. "Okay, let's go and read my fan mail." He turned to Giordino. "See if you can tear our queen bee away from her ardent admirers for a few minutes and escort her to Gunn's cabin. I want to ask her one or two very personal questions." Giordino grinned. "From the looks of that crowd, I'll probably get lynched if I try." "If things get too tough, just flash your gun," Pitt said sarcastically. "But don't forget to remove the safety." Giordino's mouth dropped open like a landed fish. Before he could recover, Pitt and Gunn had left. The radio man, a young black in his early 20s, looked up when they entered. "This one just came in for you, sir." He handed the message to Gunn. Gunn studied it for a moment, then his lips slowly arched into a wide smile. "Listen to this. To Commander Gunn, officer commanding Numa ship first attempt. What in the goddamn hell kind of hornet's nest have you people stirred up in the Aegean? I sent you out there to study sea life, not play cops and robbers. You are hereby ordered to render every assistance, repeat, every assistance at your command to the local Interpol authorities. And don't return home without a goddamn teaser. Admiral James Sandecker, Numa, Washington." "I'd say the Admiral is a bit off his usual form," murmured Pitt. "He used goddamn only twice." "Please lead me out of the dark," Gunn asked mildly. "What possible assistance could we be to Interpol?" Pitt pondered a moment. Gunn would have to be led up to a crucial decision. It was decidedly too early to bear all the facts. Pitt dodged the question. We may be the only hope left to destroy Von Till and his empire. It may mean taking a few risks, but the stakes are high. Gunn removed his glasses and stared sharply at Pitt. How high? Enough heroin to hop up the entire population of the United States and Canada, Pitt said slowly. 130 tons worth, to be exact. Gunn betrayed no sign of surprise. He calmly held up his glasses to the light, examining the lenses for smudges. Satisfied there were none, he replaced the horned rims over his low-set ears. Offhand, I'd say that's a pretty fair amount. Why didn't you tell me about this last night when you brought the girl on board? I needed more time and more answers, and right now I'm still short on both. But I think I've run onto something that will put this whole insane puzzle into a transparent pattern. I still don't know what you expect from me. We've got to hit Von Till below the belt. Way below the belt. This is an underwater show. I need every able-bodied man you can spare with scuba gear and weapons that can be carried in water. Diving knives, spear guns, anything. What guarantee can you give me that no one will get hurt? Absolutely none, Pitt said quietly. Gunn stared at Pitt for a full 10 seconds, his face expressionless. You realize the seriousness of what you're asking me? Most of the men aboard this ship are scientists, not commandos. They're tigers with a salinometer, a Nansen bottle, or a microscope, but their skill at knifing another man in the guts or shooting a barbed spear into a navel leaves much to be desired. What about the crew? All good men to have on your side in a barroom brawl, but like most professional seamen, they have an unhealthy dislike for any activity below the surface. They can't, or rather won't, put on a face mask and dive. Gunn shook his head. I'm sorry, Dirk, you're asking too much. Come off it, Pitt snapped rudely. This isn't the Little Bighorn, and I'm not asking you to send the 7th Cavalry against Sitting Bull and the Sioux Nation. Look, not 50 miles from here, a Minerva Lines freighter is churning across the Aegean with a cargo that is as lethal as any nuclear bomb. If that amount of heroin were dumped on the market in the States, our grandchildren would still be suffering from the cultural shockwaves. It's a nightmarish thought. Pitt paused, letting his words sink in. He lit a cigarette and then continued. The Bureau of Narcotics and the Customs Department will be waiting. They've set a trap. If, and that's a big if, all goes well, the heroin and the smugglers, plus half the illegal drug sellers in the States, will be neatly scooped up and salted away behind bars. Then what's the problem, Gunn pressed? Where do the divers fit into the picture? Let's just say I have a nagging doubt. Von Till hasn't come within a nautical mile of being caught with the goods, so to speak, for decades. Legally, our government agents can't board the cargo ship until it touches the United States continental shelf 3 weeks away. By then, Von Till might sense that Interpol is behaving overly cagey. Rather than cooperate with the good guys and sail into the trap, he'd have to reroute the ship at the last minute or else dump the heroin in the Atlantic. That leaves the narcotics agents and the customs inspectors standing around with nothing to do but play with themselves. The only sure way, the safe way, is to stop the ship now, before it leaves the Mediterranean. You're the man who said it. Legally, it can't be done. There is one way. Pitt drew on the cigarette, then slowly let the smoke trickle through his nose. Prove a solid case against Von Till and Minerva Lines before morning. Gunn shook his head again. Even then, boarding a ship in international waters, particularly a ship that is registered to a friendly nation, can lead to political repercussions. I doubt if any country would want to touch it. There is one opportunity, Pitt said. The ship stops at Marseille for fuel. Interpol would have to work fast. If they received the necessary evidence and rushed through the legal paperwork, they could seize the ship in port. Gunn leaned against the doorway and gave Pitt a penetrating stare. The catch is that you want to risk the lives of the people under my command. It has to be, Pitt said quietly. I think you're hedging, Gunn said slowly. You're up to your ears in stormy waters. I don't like any of it. I'm responsible to Numa for this ship and its personnel. All that interests me is the safe completion of this expedition. Why us? I don't see why Interpol or the local police can't conduct their own search operation. Finding divers on the mainland is no problem. This was getting too damn awkward, Pitt thought. At this stage of the game, he couldn't let on that Zakynthos was very much against even the slightest harassment of Von Till. Pitt had known Gunn for a little over a year, and in that time they had become good friends. The commander was a smart customer. The next scene would have to be played cool, very cool indeed. Pitt gazed suspiciously at the busy radio operator for a moment, then turned back to Gunn. Call it fate, coincidence, or any other term you wish to choose that put the first attempt at Thassos at the exact moment to expose a beautifully planned criminal conspiracy. Von Till's entire smuggling operation depends upon the use of a submarine. Maybe more than one, we don't know yet. The heroine is the biggest job he's ever undertaken. It's damn hard for the mind to conceive, but he could easily net over $200 million on this one shipment. He planned well. Nothing could stand in his way. Then, one day, he looks out of his window, and there sits an oceanographic research ship not over 2 miles away. Learning that you were scouting the water for a legendary fish, he began to run scared. There was a good chance that one of your divers might discover his base of operation and, what's most important, his method of smuggling. He was desperate. He couldn't blow you out of the water. The last thing he wanted was a full-scale investigation into the loss of this ship. There was no hope of instigating anti-American riots or violence. The people who live on the island are fun-loving farmers and fishermen. They couldn't care less about staging a demonstration against a scientific expedition. If anything, they welcomed you. The local merchants aren't about to turn down free-spending researchers. Von Till gambled on a long shot. He staged that attack on Brady Field, hoping Colonel Lewis would order you out of the area as a safety precaution. When this failed, he threw caution to the winds and came directly at the first attempt. "I don't know," Gunn said hesitantly. "You make it sound logical. Except for the submarines. No civilian can go to his nearest yacht broker and buy a submarine." The only way Von Till could lay his hands on a sub without attracting attention would be to raise one that was sunk in shallow water during time of war. "You're beginning to sound interesting," Gunn said quietly. He was tuned in on Pitt's channel now. He had the shrewd look of an old prospector who just discovered a map to a hidden gold mine. Pitt went on. "This is a job for professional underwater divers. By the time Interpol could put together a team of their own, it would be too late." The last was only a half-truth, but it served Pitt admirably to drive home the next point. "The time is now. And other than Cousteau, you've got the finest divers and equipment in the Mediterranean. I'm not going to give you any crap about being the last hope of mankind or that it's better to sacrifice a few to save millions. All I'm asking you is for a few volunteers to help me explore the cliffs below Von Till's villa. We may strike out and find nothing. On the other hand, we may uncover enough evidence to impound the ship and the heroine and put Von Till away for good. Hit or miss, we've got to try." Gunn said nothing. His expression indicated deep thought and concentration. Pitt looked at him, considering, and then threw in the hook. "It would be interesting if we could find out what happened to the yellow albatross." Gunn looked at Pitt across the cramped radio room and thoughtfully jangled some loose change in his pocket. A more hard-headed and determined man he had never seen. Gunn remembered that he had trusted Pitt's judgment on that Delphi Ea affair in Hawaii last year, and he hadn't been let down. If Pitt said he was going to kill every shark in the sea, Gunn mused, he would probably damn near do it. He studied the damp and, by this time, peeling bandages on Pitt's body, jangled the change in his pocket again, wondered what he would be thinking about this time tomorrow. "Okay, you win," he said wearily. "I'll no doubt regret this decision at my court-martial. It's a small satisfaction to know that I'll go out with a blaze of headlines." Pitt laughed. "No such luck, my friend. Whatever happens, you merely ordered a routine hunt to collect marine specimens from a shelf under the cliffs. If we stumble into an embarrassing incident, you can say it was by pure accident. I hope Washington will buy that. Don't worry. I think we both know Admiral Sandecker well enough to be assured that he'll stand by us regardless of the consequences. Gunn pulled a handkerchief from his hip pocket and dabbed at the sweat on his face and neck. Well, where do we go from here? Round up your volunteers, Pitt said briefly. Assemble them and the equipment on the fantail at noon. I'll explain their mission with a few well-chosen words, and then we'll go from there. Gunn glanced at his watch. It's 9 now. I can have them ready to dive in 15 minutes. Why wait 3 hours? I need the extra time to catch up on my sleep, Pitt said, grinning. I don't want to doze off 60 feet below the surface. That's not a bad idea, Gunn said seriously. You look like the morning after New Year's Eve. He turned and started through the cabin door, then stopped. By the way, do me a favor and send that girl ashore as soon as possible. I'm going to be in enough hot water as it is without being accused of operating a floating bordello. Not until I return from the dive. It's vital that she remain on board where someone can keep an eye on her. Okay, let's have it, Gunn said quietly in a defeated tone. You're holding out on me again. Who is she? Would you believe Von Till's niece? Oh, no, Gunn looked stricken. That's all I need. Don't work yourself into a coronary, Pitt said softly. Everything will work out. You have my word on it. I hope so, Gunn sighed. He looked skyward and shrugged in helpless despair. Why me, God? Then he was gone. Pitt stared out the empty doorway for a long moment at the blue, uneven sea. The radio operator was bent over the big Bendix set, transmitting, but Pitt didn't hear him. He was lost in the inner silence of concentration, and the silence that comes with the blistering heat and its energy-sapping partner, humidity. His body was numb. Numb from too little sleep and numb from too much mental strain. His nerves were stretched like the support wires of a suspension bridge. If one snapped, the rest would part strand by strand until the whole structure swayed and dropped into oblivion. Like a gambler who has bet his last big stake on a 10-to-1 horse, he felt his heart pound against his rib cage, driven beyond its regular beat by the deep fear of uncertainty. Excuse me, Major. The radioman's low, resonant voice seemed far away. These communications are for you. Pitt said nothing. He merely extended his hand and took the messages. The one from Munich came in at 6. The black man's tone was hesitating and unsteady. It was followed at 7 by 2 transmissions from Berlin. Thank you, Pitt murmured woodenly. Anything else? This last one, sir, it's really weird. No call sign, no repeat, no sign off, just the message. Pitt stared down at the top paper. A grim smile slowly moved his lips. Major Dirk Pitt, Neuma ship first attempt. 1 hour down, 9 to go. HZ. Any reply, Major? The voice stammered unevenly. Suddenly, Pitt became aware of the sickly expression on the radio operator's face. You feel all right? To tell the truth, Major, no. Ever since breakfast, I've had the worst case of bowel drizzlies in my life, and I've barfed twice. Pitt could not help grinning. Compliments of the ship's cook, is that it? The radioman shook his head and rubbed his eyes in one easy movement. Can't be. Cookie's the greatest. Strictly Gourmetsville. Nah, it's probably the local version of the flu. Could even be a skunky bottle of beer or something. Stay with it, Pitt said. We need a good man on the radio for the next 24 hours. You can count on me. The radioman forced a faint smile. Besides, that chick you brought on board has been clucking over me like a mother hen. With that kind of attention, how much could I suffer? Pitt raised an eyebrow. You must see something in her I don't. She's not bad. Not my usual fancy, but not bad. Anyway, she's been bringing tea all morning, a regular Florence Nightingale. The young black suddenly broke off. His eyes went wide and he threw a hand to his mouth. Then he jumped to his feet, knocking over the chair, ran outside and hung like a dead man over the railing. Animal-like grunts carried back into the cabin, accompanied by low, agonizing moans. Pitt walked out and lightly patted the ailing radioman on the back. I need you by the radio, my friend. Hang in there while I send for the ship's doctor. The radioman slowly nodded his head and said nothing. Then Pitt turned and left, making sure he walked upwind. After a few minutes, spent looking for the ship's physician and asking him to look in on the radio operator, Pitt entered Gunn's cabin and found it dark, the curtains drawn. Cool air flowed from the ventilator, giving the steel cubicle a comfortable, inviting atmosphere. A vast improvement over the intolerable heat of yesterday. In the dim light, he made out Terry sitting on the desk. Her chin was resting on a drawn-up knee. She looked up at him and smiled.
What kept you?
Business, he replied.
Monkey business, I'll bet.
Her face bore a distinct feminine pout.
Where is the big adventure you promised me? Every time I turn around, you've disappeared.
When duty calls, dear heart, I must answer. Pitt straddled a chair and leaned over the backrest. A very intriguing bit of apparel you're wearing. Where did you get it?
Nothing to it, really.
I can see that. She smiled at his remark and went on. I simply snipped out a pattern from some pillow ticking. The halter is tied in the back with a bow, and the pants are knotted on each side. See? She stood and undid the knot over her left hip, letting the diminutive cloth dangle teasingly. Very, very clever. What do you do for an encore?
How much is it worth to you? She asked seductively.
How about an old Milwaukee streetcar token?
You're impossible, she pouted. I'm beginning to think you're daft.
He had to force his eyes to ignore her body. Right now I've got some details that need clearing up. She stared at him blankly for a few seconds, started to say something, then thought better of it. His face was unsmiling and serious. She shrugged, slowly retied the bikini, and settled into a vacant chair.
You're acting terribly mysterious.
I'll revert to my old, sweet, lovable self after you've answered a few simple questions. She scratched at an imaginary itch above her left breast.
Ask away, then.
Question number one. What do you know about your uncle's smuggling operations? Her eyes went wide.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you do.
You're insane, she said, glaring at him. Uncle Bruno owns a steamship line. Why should a man of his wealth and social standing stoop to petty smuggling?
Nothing he does can be considered petty, Pitt said. He paused a moment, monitoring her expression, and then continued. Question number two. Before you came to Thassos, when was the last time you saw Von Till?
Not since I was a little girl, she answered vaguely.
My mum and dad were drowned when their sailboat overturned in a sudden storm off the Isle of Man. Uncle Bruno was with them at the time.
So was I. He saved my life. Since that awful accident, he has been very good to me. The best boarding schools, money when I needed it. He always remembers my birthday.
Yes, he's all heart, Pitt said sarcastically. Isn't he a bit old to be your uncle?
Actually, he was my grandmother's brother.
Question three. How come you never paid him a visit before now?
Whenever I wrote and begged him to let me come to Thassos, he always wrote back and said he was too busy, involved with some vast shipping transaction or something.
She giggled softly. I fooled him this time, though. I simply popped in and surprised him. What do you know about his past?
Nothing, really. He talks very little about himself. But I do know he's not a smuggler.
Your beloved uncle is the worst scum that a mother ever dropped. Pitt's voice was tired. He didn't want to hurt her, but he was certain she was lying. God only knows how many rotting corpses owe their present condition to him. Hundreds,
thousands more likely. And you're in it with him right up to your lovely little neck. Every rotten dollar you've spent in the last 20 years was soaked in blood. In some cases with the blood of, and yes, tears, especially tears of innocent children. Young girls who were stolen from their parents' arms and who finished their adolescence on a filthy, lice-ridden pile of straw in a North African whorehouse. She jumped to her feet. Things like that don't happen anymore. You're lying. You're lying. You're making this up. She was scared now, but playing a magnificent scene, Pitt thought. I told you the truth. I know nothing. Nothing. Nothing? You knew Von Till was planning to murder me at the villa. Your tearful little act on the terrace, I admit, had me fooled, but not for long. You missed your calling. You should have been an actress.
I didn't know. Her voice was low and desperate. I swear I didn't.
Pitt shook his head. I can't buy it. You gave yourself away outside the labyrinth when we were arrested by the tourist guide. You weren't just surprised to see me. You were goddamn shocked to see me in one piece. She came over and knelt beside him and held his hands in hers.
Please, please. Oh, God, what must I do to make you believe me?
You might begin by offering me facts. He raised up from the chair and stood directly over her. Then he tore the soggy bandages from his chest and dropped them in her lap. Look at me. This is what I got for accepting your invitation to dinner. I was set up as the main course for your uncle's man-eating dog. Look at me. She looked.
I think I'm going to be sick.
Pitt ached to take her in his arms and kiss away the tears that welled in her eyes, and to softly, gently tell her how sorry he was. Instead, he fought to keep his voice firm and even. She turned and gazed blankly at the metal sink in the head, wondering if she were going to be sick or not. Then she forced her tear-brimmed eyes back on Pitt and spoke in a whisper.
You're a devil. You talk about Uncle Bruno. You're worse, much worse. I wish you would have been killed.
The hate should have been there, but Pitt could only feel a touch of sadness. Until I say otherwise, you'll remain on this ship.
You can't keep me here. You have no right.
I have no right, true, but I can keep you here. And while we're on the subject, don't get it in your pretty head to try and escape. The men on this ship are expert swimmers. You wouldn't get 50 yards even if you tried real hard.
You can't keep me a prisoner forever.
Her face twisted with loathing. A woman had never looked at Pitt like that. It made him feel uneasy. If my little caper comes off as planned this afternoon, you'll be out of my hair and in the hands of the gendarmerie by supper time. Suddenly, Terry stared at him speculatively.
Is that why you disappeared last night?
Pitt was ever amazed at the way her huge brown eyes, her devastatingly beautiful eyes, could run through so many emotions in one blink. Yes, as a matter of fact, I sneaked on board one of your uncle's ships just before dawn. It was a most instructive excursion. You'll never guess what I found. He watched her closely, mentally predicting what the next blink would bring.
I couldn't imagine, she said dully. The only ships I've ever been on were ferries.
He walked over and sat down in the bunk. The soft mattress felt good. He leaned back and crossed his arms behind his head. Then he yawned long and slowly. I beg your pardon, that was rude of me.
Well?
Well, what?
You were going to tell me what you found on Uncle Bruno's ship.
Pitt shook his head and grinned. Female curiosity, once piqued, it's insatiable. Since you insist, I found a map to an underwater cave.
A cave?
Of course. Where else do you think your good uncle conducts his slimy business from?
Why are you telling me these stories?
The hurt look was back.
None of them can be true.
Oh, good God, get some sense in your head. I'm not telling you anything new. Von Till may have hoodwinked Interpol, the Gendarmerie, and the Bureau of Narcotics, but he didn't fool yours truly.
You're talking nonsense, she said slowly.
Am I? He asked thoughtfully. At precisely 4:30 this morning, your uncle's ship, the Queen Artemisia, anchored off the coast below the villa.
The ship was loaded to the gills with heroin. Surely you must know about the heroin. Everyone else does. It has to be the worst-kept secret of the year. I've got to hand it to your uncle. He's a master of the old magician's routine. Dazzle the audience with one hand while you perform the trick with the other. His little act is about to end, however. I have a little trick of my own that will bring down the curtain. She was silent for a moment.
What are you going to do?
What any red-blooded all-American boy would do. I'm going to take Giordino and a couple of other men and dive along the shore until I find the cave. It most likely lies at the base of the cliffs directly under the villa. Once we discover the entrance, we will enter, seize any equipment and evidence, make a citizen's arrest of your uncle, and then call the gendarmerie.
You're insane, she said again, only with much more feeling this time. The whole caper, or whatever you call it, is idiotic. You can't go through with it. Please, please believe me, it won't work.
It's no use begging. You can kiss your uncle and his rotten money goodbye. We hit the water at 1. Pitt yawned again. Now, if you will kindly excuse me, I'd like to get a little shut-eye. The tears were back. She shook her head slowly from side to side.
It's idiotic, she whispered over and over, turned and walked into the head, slamming the door behind her.
Pitt lay there, staring at the overhead. She was right, of course, he thought. It did sound like an idiotic caper. But then, what else could she think? She only knew the half of it.